Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Waite, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. Kathleen George is a theater professor at the University of Pittsburgh, where she has earned a PhD in theater and a subsequent MFA in fiction. She and her husband live in Pittsburgh on the city's historic North Side. The Odds is the fourth in a series of mystery novels that was initiated with the book Taken. So, hi, Kathy. Welcome to
Prosody.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
I'd be happy to. I'm going to read a section from fairly far on in the novel. It's a section where the most innocent person meets the most guilty person. And the innocent person is a little boy named Joel. And he is out trying to get car washes to help support his family. Joel was toting his bucket. He hadn't got much today, only an old Taurus. He didn't hear the van pull up beside him. "Hey, you." He looked up. He thought at first the man wanted to get his car washed. "For a van, $5," he said. "Oh, really, that's quite a deal. Maybe I should get it washed. Meanwhile, I want to talk. How about you get over here?" Joel stopped in his tracks, but then started moving again. "I'm busy. There's another car I'm supposed to..." "Come on, I can make it worth your while," the man said. He held up a 20. He kept the car idling down the street as Joel walked. Not what you think. This is just a question about somebody I need to find." "No," Joel kept walking. "Okay, wait a sec then." The man went ahead, put the car in park, and got out. He was large, olive-skinned, with closely cropped hair. Joel could not remember having seen him before, but he knew to be scared. "Hey, kid, you sure got your lessons about not talking to strangers, only I'm not a stranger. Basically, I know people you know, see? And I need to talk to you." "What about?" Joel asked. He hated that he was shaking and that he wanted to run. "When did you last go up to that house where they found the body?" "Was the man police? Plain clothes?" "What house?" "Don't lie. I know all about it. Carl, Nick, where'd they go? Nick Banks?" "I don't know. I don't know who you mean." In an instant, everything changed. The man was on him, twisting his arm until his shoulder hurt. "Why are you running if there's nothing wrong?" "I'm not running. Let me go." "Not just yet. So, you know where he is?" "How would I know?" The man tightened his grip. "Well, let's hope you get a little smarter, huh?" Joel looked up and down the street, wondering where to run. He remembered people went in and out of the Lutheran church at various times of day. Maybe he could be safe there. "Well, I need to get hold of him, okay?" "Okay." He made himself stop pulling in order to give the impression he was going to settle down and talk. "Okay." But all the while, he figured out what he had to do. "I still don't know who you mean. A lot of people went up to that house." He imagined himself down the alley, around the corner, and inside the Lutheran church. The man's grip tightened. "Lots, plus Carl. How about the guy who worked the pizza shop?" "I don't know any pizza shop guy." "You little liar." The man turned him and pushed him against the van, then raised a hand as if to hit him. "You lying little piece of..." Joel thought his shoulder socket would dislocate the way he had to wrench away, but he did it all at once and ran and ran and ran, leaving his bucket and brush right on the street. He ran like an athlete, like wind down the street, so fast he felt unreal, or the pavement did. It was something that surprised him when he looked down. Blocks of cement, one after another, some blocks cracked, some higher than others. He saw what a sidewalk was, as if for the first time in his life. He ran right into the church, down the steps, past a meeting room, past a men's room, a ladies' room, and into a corridor. He stopped. For a long time, he listened. If the man came in asking for him, he would scream until somebody heard him. But when he realized what that meant, when he stopped and breathed, the thought crowded in that there would be questions about where he lived, his family. When he realized all that, he wanted to give up. He pressed himself against the wall, gasping. Maybe the man was a cop. No, he wasn't. Joel listened for footsteps. All he heard for several minutes was the hum of voices, people talking, and then the hum seemed to be coming from a room somewhere around the corner. The first notes of a hymn were struck by a piano. There was a pause, and the piano started again. Somebody who believed in playing hard was doing just that, as if to force power from the wavering voices that followed uncertainly. Joel tried to hear past the hymn. Then the worst thing happened. He could hear people leaving, chairs scraping, and murmurs of goodbye. His heart beat wildly. He listened for the piano. Nothing. After about 5 minutes, all the voices were gone. Then, when he was about to move, he heard footsteps. Joel leaned back into a well in the corridor. Ahead was a man with long hair, walking slowly, looking as if he were in a movie, playing Jesus, just contemplating the Sea of Galilee. To Joel's right was an open closet, made of wood, with 30 or 40 choir robes hanging there. He slid in, plastered himself against the back wall of it. Inside, he was almost laughing, almost crying. The lilac-colored material, silky, covered his face so that he thought he would smother. He was swimming, tangled in purple robes that smelled of deodorants and perfumes. He listened for the footsteps of the man he'd seen. The walking continued unhurried. Lights went out, one after another. Suddenly the place was plunged in darkness. He was in a basement, no windows at all. It seemed as if night had fallen and he'd lost a day. When the footsteps were gone, he missed them. After a few moments of silence, he panicked like a drowning swimmer, batting the robes away. He turned every which way, trying to make his eyes take in some light. After a very long time, they did. He listened again. There was nothing to hear except his heart pounding loudly.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. So, you know, I was thinking about it, and you were my first interview on Prosody. I think we've talked about this before.
Yes, we have.
Many years ago. And I remember that was when Taken first came out. And I think at that point you were kind of getting used to the form of the mystery. And now, you know, you're a number of books into it. And I was wondering if you've, you know, I was thinking about it that some people, I guess I'm thinking of in terms of poetry, there are some poets who don't like to write in form because they want to do something other than that. And then there are some poets who feel that form is a way that, you know, then you just work within the rules and that's what's really interesting about it. And so I think, you know, mystery and some other prose forms, it's the same kind of thing. So now that you're these many books into it, what are you thinking about the form now?
I'm fighting against it. In fact, in this book, there's a lot of the material on a lot of the scenes have to do with these children and not with the police or the police procedures. But the police are here in it, and it's still part of the series. Detective Commander Christie is still there and working the case. But it turned out that my editor said, I love these kids. Start with the kids. We're sticking with the kids on this one. And I was glad that I didn't have to make excuses for having such long scenes with the children.
Is that something you feel in terms of kind of the form of mystery, that if it's not directly related to the case? Because there are, I mean, the kids are involved in the novel and what goes on in the novel, but they have like their whole other narrative line that just has to do with other things.
Oh, right. Their plot line is pretty different. They happen to be children abandoned living on the north side where there are some drug runners, and they get involved with some of them. And so they're in danger, a good deal of the time in danger, but not because they are part of the criminal network themselves.
Yeah, I found that was it was a way that this novel is evolving in terms of your career as someone who works with the mystery form. Because, I mean, you've also written short stories and you've written, you know, critical pieces and essays, that it's a way that you're kind of pushing the form a bit. But I just wanted to see, like, how you were feeling this many books in.
I think I'm a rebellious personality anyway, so give me a form and I'm going to look for ways to have them still want it but have me do my thing.
That's great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. Kathleen, would you read some more?
Oh, I'd love to. I'm going to pick this up when Joel gets enough courage to leave the basement of the church. He pressed the crash bar in one quick movement. At first, it didn't open. He pushed again, and it did. No alarm sounded, and he was tumbled outside where he came face to face with another person. Before him stood the bearded man with the shiny long hair and the removed, peaceful face. For a moment, the two of them looked at each other. The man was smoking. "Whoa," the man said. "I thought I found myself a special place." It was funny, really, how much he looked like all those pictures of Jesus. A little sad, a small tilt to his head, thin. His hair went the whole way to his shoulders. "Can I help you?" He stood very straight and seemed to protect the fall of his hair. He had a wistful smile. Joel wanted to scan the surroundings for that other one who'd accosted him, but it seemed impolite to interrupt the slow movements of the man before him. "You were in there? Where?"
"Downstairs somewhere."
"You live around here?"
"Yes, I was hiding."
The man blinked in puzzlement. "Someone was after me."
"Nothing bad, I hope."
Joel shook his head slightly.
"You must have been scared. I would have helped you if I'd known. How old are you?"
"Almost 12.
"You have brothers and sisters?"
"I have a sister almost 11, another one 7, and the oldest of us is almost 14.
"You could just say what age you really are."
"I guess." Joel turned his head finally. He looked behind him and around again. He didn't see anyone else.
"Does your family have a church?"
The man looked longingly at the stub of his cigarette and dropped it, then stepped on it almost sorrowfully, as Joel's father used to do with a pest he couldn't persuade himself to let live, like a huge carpenter ant.
"Not anything steady," Joel answered.
"Let me get you some brochures for your parents. We have a summer program. It stops at age 12, so it's good for you and your two younger sisters. Come with me. We have to go around to the front."
Joel felt sick and his heart pounded.
That's okay. I have to go."
"No, come. I don't mind. My name is Gordon. Yours?"
"Joel."
The side of the church was windowless. There were a few beaten-down buildings across the alley from it. The whole way around the building, Joel expected to discover someone hiding, watching, and ready to spring. Gordon moved swiftly now. Without a word to each other, the two went inside the church. Joel's sneakers squeaked on the stone floor of the lobby.
"Joe?"
He did not correct the man.
"Did you see the upstairs when you were hiding?"
"No."
"Take a look."
They passed through glass doors into the church proper, where they stood behind the pews and looked at the altar with its dark wood and purple cloth up ahead. The stained glass was modern, just a bunch of triangles, not elaborate like the windows of old churches with people washing feet and kneeling in prayer.
Space. There was space here. It was calm and clean.
Gordon led him to the office at the side of the vestibule. The office was large and had a big counter in front, like a school office. From this counter, Gordon plucked three brochures, which he then handed to Joel.
"The Bible school program starts as soon as school is over. There are outings. We provide lunches. Do you think you could get your parents to come by and talk to me?"
Lunches. For Susanna, anyway. "I'll try." Joel wondered if people went into church work, that they tried to look a certain way, or if they were born with high foreheads and intense eyes and were fated to be attracted to church work.
"Do you teach the Bible school? Are you a priest?"
"I just work here. The head honcho is called a pastor. This is a Lutheran church."
Joel accepted the brochures. "Thank you. I'd probably better get going."
"Listen, if your friends are rough on you, avoid them."
"I will."
"And don't skip school. Learning is important." When Joel left, he went around to the alley and stood for a long time against the side of the church before he moved on to the side of a garage. After that, he darted to another building and waited, going very still, listening, searching in every direction. He stuffed the brochures into his shirt. He wanted desperately to be home, but he couldn't hurry, and he couldn't, at all costs, end up leading the man who had chased him to Nick.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. One of the themes or one of the kind of storylines in the novel has to do with drug running, as you mentioned. And I started thinking about, you know, I in your acknowledgments, you're always really gracious about kind of thanking the people who have helped you learn things. And I thought, you know, some of the things you have to research are pretty tough. You know, kind of social ills, and, you know, these are homicide detectives. And so I was thinking about that, like, as the writer is the conduit. First, you have to go and do the research. And I'm sure some of these things are really shocking and hard for you to have to interact with and then or learn about. And then you have to translate it into these characters that it's their day-to-day life. So they're not going to be very shocked about things. If anything, they're going to be unsurprised. And just how you make that happen through your writing.
You're right. I do have to make it ordinary and almost familiar to me. When I start out, it isn't familiar to me. I was just in court this morning to watch a hearing of a homicide case. And it's very different from the homicide case that I'm writing at the moment. But I'm sure it's going to seep in somehow. Already I'm fascinated by a couple of the people sitting in the audience isn't the right word, but sitting in the jury house being affected by the case. And I won't say any more about it. It was a sort of private thing.
Sure.
But I'll probably use it in some way. And
Do you find you have to spend some time, like give yourself distance in order to get it from kind of the extraordinary to the ordinary? Or do you need to work with it right away just so you get it right?
I think I'm more likely to work with it right away and to figure out small details that make it real. You know, I've never been an actress, although I teach theater, and yet I do what actors do. I have to live it for a little while I'm writing it. And to do that, it's kind of like starting with just one word and then the next word until you build up a reality.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of taking it the other direction, there's a way in your writing that I think you're able, because you're a writer, to articulate this world that probably the people who work in it day to day can't. You know, you can – so it – you know, I really do think of it as this kind of conduit, this research into the writing, looking at this world and then being able to bring it back out to the reader again.
Gosh, I have to hope so. I'm always so admiring of people who know so much about things like how the world works in the legal system. And I think, here I am, how audacious I am that I should decide to write about it when I really don't know. So then I have to research everything. And there are times I think that because – I'm new to it, and I have to sift out the most important information that I don't get bogged in as many details as if I really, really knew it.
Sure.
And at least I hope that's true.
Yeah. Would you read some more for us?
Sure. I don't want people to think that Commander Christie isn't in this book, because Commander Christie is still here. However, there's a sort of shocking element in this book. He's in the hospital as the book starts, and he has quite a serious illness. And there is a question about whether he's going to make it or not. He's on chemo, and he's now home in this scene with his kids. I included scenes with his children because this book is about parents, absent ones, good ones, bad ones. It's about parenting in many, many ways. So what happens between parents and children seems to me to be important. Wednesday, and so the kids. Christie heard the car pulling up outside. Marina came into the house urging Eric and Julie along. Show him the movies you rented. His children presented the DVD sleeves awkwardly as if for his approval. Marina was saying, we're having a nice, simple pasta with just butter on it and a salad. Do smells still bother you? His daughter Julie asked. Yes. Bummer. Well, the good news is I get a break for the rest of the week and all of next week, and then the week after I'm supposed to be back on it. But then I get a break again. Don't worry, it'll work out. It's nice outside, Eric said. Let's go out back then, Christie said. He made himself walk normally to the back door. The humid air assaulted him. It was going to rain soon, for sure. What do you want to do? Eric rocked a football in his hands, prompting the answer. Okay, toss it to me, but easy, easy. Work on the spin, not force. You sure? I'm sure. Already he felt better using his body. He was going to try going in to work tomorrow. A couple of hours. He needed it. He wanted to be back at work laughing over the insane things that came at them every day. He wanted to be there to watch out for Pataki and Greer, who had their hands full with Farber. The football hit him hard in the stomach. You hit him, Julie cried. Why don't you be careful? It's okay, he said, even though it wasn't quite. How bizarre that you could walk around in your body for months, years, and not know the bad things going on inside it until the chaos reached certain proportions and the alarms went off. Then the body talked back all right. Later, he stood in the kitchen watching as his children set the table. They were always interesting to him, Eric remembering with a little pantomime of knife and fork to put the knife on the right, Julie catching Eric's almost mistake and silently congratulating herself for never having to think twice about how to set a table, Julie looking at Marina's long hair and freeing a strand that was caught under the strap of the apron. It was going to rain again. It seemed it rained every Wednesday. Marina said, dinner's on, and Christie straightened himself for the task.
I'm speaking tonight with the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. So one of the things I was thinking about is what keeps you interested in these characters? I mean, they come in different proportions. It's kind of, if you think of it as a stage set, you know, some go back and some come forward. But what is it that keeps you kind of engaged with them?
I'm at the point where I've got so many stories going. It's really tricky. But As I said, I gave the children a lot of stage time in this, and I found them extremely engaging. I felt like I was getting to know them, and I created them. But also, I've been interested for a long time in stories of children who are abandoned. Every time I read another story of that sort or a novel of that sort, I think how amazing it is that there is this human resilience from such a young age. And I'm just enchanted by stories of children who somehow figure out what to do when they're on their own. So I did a lot of research about parentless children, and I conceived of these children as extremely bright, so that they were doing well in school and nobody knew they were on their own. And that really kept me going. Just the fact that I could research something and know that children of 13 and 11 could also research these same things and do something with it.
There's a pretty early in the book, the oldest child is reading Dickens. Yeah. And that was a nice echo, I thought, in the book, both in the idea of, you know, Dickens having these kind of resilient young characters in his book. It was a nice kind of contemporary updating to it as well. They didn't have the internet, I think, back in his day.
No.
And there was also something that I saw just in the point of view, in using the third person, but attaching it to like various characters, that is really reminiscent of, you know, the way point of view functioned in Victorian and Dickens' work that you don't see that much anymore.
Right. Yes, Dickens had a very large cast of characters all the time, and he would manage to get you involved with all of them.
And I think as you do in your work. Can you read another short section for us?
Yes, I can.
Great.
This is a section where the oldest girl, Meg, has followed her brother, Joel, thinking he's giving away the little bit of family food they have to his friends. And she's angry with him, and she follows him up to the bad section of town. She walked through high weeds to the back door, her stomach churning. As she geared herself to step through the door, she thought about how it was all coming apart, and she wasn't going to be able to act as mother and father both. She'd end up in a fight with Joel. The other boys would make fun of her. She was shaking, thinking she'd ask for foster care on Monday when she got to school. Somebody else could take over, bad or good. At least they wouldn't be starving. Flies buzzed, droned, and came at her. She waved them away and slipped into the house. "Shh," she heard someone whisper. With a sick heart, she climbed the steps in the semi-dark. She knew something was terribly wrong even before she got to the top. The heat, the smell, the insects told her that. She screamed when she saw all the blood, the dead man. Over in the corner to her left was her brother Joel. Joel, bag, man, in that order. Joel, bag, man. "Who's that?" the man said. Everything stopped. The square of light glanced off his hair. She saw who he was. He was hurt. She couldn't take her eyes from his. Startling blue eyes, beautiful eyes. Quickly she managed to take in the rest, his dark hair, his scowl, the way he leaned over his leg, the dirt, the surroundings. "Oh," she said, "it's you."
One of the things I was thinking, too, has to do with when you have characters who have lived in four different books, you obviously have an audience that's very familiar with them, very engaged with them. And what's the kind of feedback you get besides the fact I'm sure people keep reading the books and they like the books, but is there ever a time when you've done something with one of the characters that someone might say, "Oh, you know, why did that happen?" Because in a certain sense, now your audience is kind of in the mix as well.
Yeah, I love it when people get involved and get surprised by things too. I remember the editor that I had for the first two books. When she got to the manuscript of the second book, she said, "Christy married her so quickly," you know. And I said, "Oh, yes, he's very conventional." She said, "Good," you know. But she was assuming that I was going to keep that sort of going as a sort of long romantic thing through several novels. But I didn't think it was true to the character. I thought that he was a guy who wanted to be married, and
yeah,
that was it, you know.
That I think that's kind of an impulse. We see that like in television shows and stuff where they feel somehow that if the romantic interest is lost, then the whole story deflates. And I think that's just a case where there's not enough story, that has to be the one backbone piece. Have you ever had readers of your book give you suggestions?
Yes. My sister's mother-in-law said, I loved every minute of it, but somebody should have been sleeping with somebody by the end of your book. She said, I want more sex. And I was like, oh, really?
Well, there you go. So you have that in your head next time you're sitting down writing a romance section of the book. So do you have one very short section you could read?
I do. Let me see which one is going to... I should introduce this fellow Nick. He's the fellow at the pizza shop that you've been hearing about, and he has very beautiful blue eyes. Nick had put things away and was cleaning up after the girl left. He usually closed at 10, but he was cutting out early because Marco had told him to give himself a break. Marco didn't care if the shop turned a profit or not, yet somehow Nick found himself taking everything about it seriously. Flyers on the counter, fresh ingredients, cleanliness. It was quiet now. The refrigerator unit kicked on with a loud sound that made him jump. Because the machine grunted and sweated, he felt every time he wiped it down like a boy on a farm grooming a horse. When the door opened again, he was hardly surprised to see Carl, the kid who came in 4 or 5 times each day. He was one of Marco's street runners. Nick had figured that out after the first couple weeks. Because of that other connection, Marco didn't want the kid coming around. Yet Carl kept showing up, and he never ordered anything. He was using, so he was never much for eating. The kid had confided to Nick a day or two ago that he was getting straight. Nick supposed they all said that, but then Carl added, I heard one guy on the radio wrote a book about it. I went to the library, but they didn't have the book. People have done it, got off it solo. I never got on it, Nick told him. Carl had leveled him a look. Booze, that's your poison. Carl was a funny kid, 18, with a big, thick head of curly, dark hair and big eyes. He was tall, skinny, and sometimes appeared younger than his years. Tonight the boy looked like he had the flu. Eyes looked sick. Buy you dinner, Nick said now. He quickly finished up in the shop and told himself the whole time he picked up stray napkins and swept the floor that he couldn't wait to be done with Marco, to pay off his debt and be gone. But the truth edged in that he actually liked the simple, humble pie of the job. Hot water, yeast, dough, and an accounting for each of his hours.
Kathleen George, reading from her novel, The Odds. Kathleen, thanks for coming to Prosody.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.